Well, I certainly enjoyed the book. Extremely well done. One of the parts I liked best, I think, were the period in Harvard. And I liked also the period at Oxford. One thing I liked very much was the characterization of the poet, whose name escapes me.
Morgan Ames?
Morgan Ames. It was obviously Robert Lowell, but in a different persona. I think he pictured Ames as a much larger being than... I never knew Lowell, but I've seen photographs of Lowell, and he seemed rather slight man. Is that...
Oh, no, Lowell was pretty big.
Was he big?
Yes.
Oh, yeah?
I think I say somewhere in the book that he was full back size,
right.
And that was about it. He was a powerful character.
Oh. Yeah, well, I didn't... I thought you had just described the... disguised the character a little bit by the physical size, but I did read Ian Hamilton's biography of Lowell, but for some reason I didn't... never got a picture of his actual physical size. Even though he lived here in New York and I lived in New York, I never, for some reason, ran into him, so I never saw him. I did see photographs of him, for example, with during the Chicago... not Chicago, the Washington... Vietnam demonstration,
oh, yeah.
Herman Mahler and so forth, and still he... And Mahler is small.
Yes, Mahler is small. That surprised me as much as Lowell's gigantic stature, but to find out Norman Mahler was...
That was... That was I think that was probably my favorite part of the whole book, the poet and his acolytes in Harvard and the hangers-on and this sort of... That was very interesting. Why did you decide to use Ames instead of Lowell? Why didn't you just come out and use Lowell?
Well, I had an exact reason for that. It's true, there's no point in being coy about the identity in this case, because I had actually published a chapter of this in The Atlantic as autobiography several years ago. But when I came to write this narrative, this fictional narrative, and began to put other characters into the scene, I realized that when you're dealing with a public figure, you can't simply put him in your book. People do, but it did take on a quality of invention with Ben's friend Bob and their competitiveness during the seminar and all the pupils vying for his attention. That really was not quite the way it happened, and I didn't feel that I had the right to put Lowell in my fantasy, so I changed the name.
Well, tell me a little bit about this period in Harvard and Lowell. And apparently there were plenty of people vying for his attention. You've mentioned in the novel about his Wednesday morning open house or open office hours that nobody knew about except through word of mouth. Tell me a little bit about that period, because you studied under Lowell, didn't you?
Yes, I did. This was in the late 60s, and I remember first my excitement at reading in the Harvard catalog, when it was sent to my home in Evanston, Illinois, that Lowell was actually teaching there. This seemed phenomenal in itself. I'd never met any living writer, and the idea that one could simply go and study with someone whose work I'd read so assiduously in high school just seemed impossible to me. And that turned out to be somewhat true, because when I arrived there, I learned that his course really was closed to freshmen, and was very difficult to get into. When you showed up on the first day for the seminar, the room was jammed. There must have been 100 people there, and he could only take 10 or 12. So they generally tended to be older students, even graduate students. But I applied again the next year, and I did get into the class, and I did sit there imbibing his incredible knowledge of poetry and of human character. First semester, only to discover that there was a deeper level of access, let's put it, to Lowell. And that was accorded only to graduate students and writers who may have even published a poem or two in journals, writers and poets in their 20s, some of whom just lived in Cambridge and came to the seminar and had nothing to do with Harvard. I only discovered that by accident when I spotted one of my teaching fellows going into the room where this course was given. It was in an underground bunker with cinder block walls and no windows, and there was no way to find out about it except by accident. But this was an even more exclusive group than the seminar, which gradually filled out with hangers-on and whoever wanted to simply listen to him. at the office hours, as they were called. It was really a small coterie of six or seven people. Sometimes a well-known poet in town would come in and happen to be visiting and read poems. And it was conducted just on the same principle as the seminar. In other words, we would bring poems and read them. And once in a while, I remember, he would read his own work, which was quite an incredible experience.
Were you blessed with a luncheon date with him?
I did have one, the one described in the book, and it was more or less that way, with another student fighting his way in.
I was going to say, there seemed to be some competitiveness among the students trying to get his attention.
Well, there was. It looked good for a while there, as if I was going to have lunch alone with him, and then this other elbowed his way to the table, and that was that. I had to share.
Yeah. Yeah, he may have been overbearing too.
Hang on just one second.
I'm
telling
you about
caping,
you get up in the middle of an interview, you walk out.
You're picking me up, okay?
Yeah, I just wanted to, because you have a resonant voice, but it's soft. I just want to make sure
don't,
just exactly the way you were. It's coming in just fine. Well, tell me a little bit about you. Obviously, The Great Pretender is autobiographical in many respects. You are also from Chicago, and you went to Harvard, and you were a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford? You were
in Oxford.
Uh-huh. It seems to follow that period of your life, and it examines the post-adolescent period of a young man's development. So tell me just how accurate is this?
Well, it's certainly accurate in some obvious ways. The lineaments of this character's career are very much like mine, and a lot of things did happen in the book that happened to me. And I confess that I did start writing it as memoir. I didn't really have the nerve early on to invent a life like mine. But as this process of narrative took over, I found myself lying uncontrollably, and a lot of the book isn't true either. I did grow up in Evanston, and I did attend Harvard and Oxford like my character, and I knew some people like those in the book, in particular my family. But there are other composite figures too. For instance, I'm not an only child. I have a brother, and my character is an only child. This is a common malady among novelists with their early books. Proust also had a brother, but he couldn't quite find room for him in his book. I'm sure my brother's glad I didn't. And so
it clutters the narrative. You can't put everybody in your book.
No, you can't put it in your own family.
Besides, some people are less interesting than others. Although your brother may be very interesting, I don't know.
Well, he is, but he didn't belong to this particular character's story. The girls in the book are very much composite figures, and there's a lot of what one commentator in Chicago recently called wishful thinking. I don't want anyone to think that I actually live the kind of risque life that this character leads.
Too bad.
I was always home studying.
Well, I was going to say, you guys in the 60s, really, based on this novel, really had it all. You know, I'm a product of the 50s, you know, and we couldn't do things like that. And I think that was my only question about the book, the sex stuff in the book, the explicit sex material, which wasn't really unusual to be shocking, and wasn't that shocking to be unusual.
Well,
I just wonder why it was necessary to put in so much of the. I know that obviously when you're dealing with post-adolescence or adolescence indeed, this is a very proper consideration among teenagers, even in my era, your era, and those following us, but I just wonder if all the explicit sex, Edwin Meese notwithstanding, is always necessary.
It certainly wasn't done for shock effect. It seemed to me that this experience was unique in a certain way. Of course, everyone's adolescence has certain universal qualities of tawdry, disappointing sexual episodes or sexual failures. And the reason I went into it in as great detail as I did was that I felt this character was under a great deal of pressure, that because of this libertarian attitude at large in the 60s. We were perhaps allowed to do more than we really wanted to or needed to or knew how to deal with, and that's what seemed to me interesting about it. The characters not going about these episodes with the gusto of a Henry Miller or with the kind of single-minded absorption of Norman Mailer. He's very troubled by it, and it is true that for a reader in the 50s or earlier, it may seem like this was all great fun, but it was my intent to make it quite clear that Ben was having a very difficult time of all this. Being free to do what you want isn't so easy, it turns out, nor is it so much fun.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Growing up in Evanston, Illinois, did you first describe an interesting family? I think the father is one who is... Do I have the correct book?
You have the correct
book. The father is the one who is constantly making literary allusions and this sort of thing. And was this pretty much the way your life was?
Well, yes, that part of the book is true. And I thought this was another, perhaps, notable feature of my background. I'm sure everyone thinks their background is notable in various ways. But my family was terribly interested, deeply interested in culture and in cultural achievements and in music and literature. And also, the families of many of my friends were the same. One of them owned the Fine Arts Station in Chicago, and others had parents who were painters and sculptors. And there was this sense of Evanston. Of course, a lot of them were lawyers and doctors, too. My own father was a doctor. But there was a sense of this strange bohemia there, that there was a middle class, an upper middle class bohemia with a sort of urgent attitude toward culture and its attainments. And when I went back there recently for a book signing party, I saw many of the people that I'd known during this period 20 years ago. It was a very moving experience because they had gone through very difficult adolescence and post-adolescence and had somehow survived, partially intact, not entirely, all these experiences of drugs and wandering around in Europe and generally being terribly rebellious. They'd grown up to have families, the way most people do. But there was a sense that some of us talked about that recent day of how our lives seemed so unusual to us, that we had had such a thirst for poetry and music. I don't know if it was when I went away to school, I didn't find that that had necessarily been shared by a great number of people.
It is not. You were blessed with having the right parents who had the right friends. I also grew up in the Middle West, and while I had a very successful family, my father was an oil executive, I grew up with Reader's Digest condensed books, and the Reader's Digest was a staple in our house, and that was about it. And so these things I found I had to seek on my own. So you did have a good jump on a lot of people, which was good for you. Your Harvard experience, tell me about that. Was that also good for you? Most people look back in their Harvard days, people I've talked to, and of course they, well, there are some mixed feelings about it, but most people are usually very proud of the fact that they have gone to Harvard, which is certainly considered our finest institution of higher education.
I don't feel too nostalgic about Harvard. In fact, it was a difficult experience for me, and I think in part that was because at Harvard you're thrown in with a group of very impressive freshmen, all of whom seem to know exactly what they're doing except you. Maybe they all feel that way, but I just remember the sense of having to make my way and discover what it was I wanted to learn and what I wanted to do there, that I found more than a challenge. I found it simply overwhelming. And I did have a number of traditional experiences there, editing the college literary magazine and belonging to a literary club. But I didn't feel that kind of intense kinship with the college that so many people do. It just seemed to me like a place where you learned a great many social skills and learned how to get a job and make your way in life, but you didn't really learn, unless you were very fortunate, what you were there to learn, which was namely how to read and think and decide what it was you wanted to do.
You didn't. You weren't the editor of that famous Robert Lowell issue.
No, I think that came. When was that? I have that issue.
That may have been in the 70s.
Yes, I think that came after. That was a very interesting issue. I did edit an issue that on John Berryman that had a lot of fascinating things in it, but that was more just a managerial function.
It became clear to you, I would assume, while you were at Harvard that writing was going to be your business.
It did. But the strange thing about it was that I had no idea how you become a writer, even after I graduated. The practical aspect of making a living and figuring out how to support yourself and how to publish your work and what to do really eluded me for many years.
Nobody teaches you that, not even in places like Iowa.
I think you have to just go out in the world and learn it on your own. I'm still learning it.
Well, what did you do after your Rhodes Scholarship period?
After that, I came back from Oxford where I had not done too much serious study. I was eager to come back and get started on this writing career, such as it was. I hadn't the faintest idea what it was I wanted to do. And I came back and began writing some disastrous novel, which I was soon saved from by an editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, who offered me a contract to write the biography of Delmore Schwartz. And that turned out to be a tremendous experience for me that occupied the next 3 or 4 years, in which I immersed myself in his life and work and his papers, which were at Yale. No one had ever been through them. And he's quite a known name these days, but he was utterly obscure in the 70s. And I found myself in my early 20s setting out to write the biography of someone whose name, when I mentioned it, just made people laugh nervously. It seemed so comical to them. And it wasn't until Saul Bellow wrote Humboldt's Gift, which was published while I was working on my book. That was a book very much about Delmore. And other memoirs began to appear that I began to feel I was on the right track. And I met all of his famous literary friends, came down to New York over the years. I was living in Cambridge then. And when that was done...
Were you teaching also?
No, I was living very much on my own there. My wife was in medical school, and I had no connection with Harvard. I just sat there and worked on this book.
Who paid the rent?
Well, I had the money from my grandmother, which I used up. I had just enough to write this book. And life was cheaper in those days, too.
Life was never cheaper. It only seems cheaper, but when you have to pay for everything, then I can assure you it was never cheaper.
Well, that may be. I was very privileged in those days, but by the time I published the book, just when my money ran out, and though it did well and got a lot of attention, it's not the kind of thing that's a big blockbuster book, and I immediately went to work at Time Magazine as a staff writer there. And since then, I've been learning the value of a dollar for the last
did that
years.
Experience at Time make it more difficult for you to want to write fiction?
Oh, in no way. I find, I don't know if this is true for all writers, they say that you're supposed to begin another project right after you finish one, but by the time I'd finished this book, I really had no desire to sit in a room and write any longer for a while. I wanted to see the world such as it is, the literary world, the journalistic world. So I worked at Time for a year, and then I went to the New York Times, where I was an editor at the Book Review and wrote for a lot of different sections of the paper and had a wonderful time. And then after about 3 years of that, I began to get a sense that I wanted to write this book. So I took a job at The Atlantic as a contributing editor, which gave me a little more time and enabled me to work at home. And that's been my career since then. Now I'm a contributing editor to Vanity Fair.
Yeah, you had a nice article in this past issue.
Well, thank you. So that's my curriculum vitae up to the age of 37.
Yeah. Well, have you indeed embarked on a new project?
I have. It's very painful to begin a new book. One never knows Well, on Earth, what it's doing. And I wrote 40 pages of it and discovered they were the wrong 40 pages, and just sat down this morning, in fact, and wrote four new pages. Mm-hmm. It's always sort of heartbreaking to start at page one, but you have to keep doing that until you get on the right track, which I hope I'm on now, but all bets are off.
Well, that's the troubled life of a fiction writer. I have no sympathy for you whatsoever. But you have done a lot of writing now. You've done a lot of literary profiles. I know I've, over the years, I've clipped a number of you. I can't remember the interviews off the top of my head, but I know that I've clipped, because I remember the byline, clipped a number of your articles, which I keep in my files.
Oh, that's nice.
So you've interviewed, I know you've interviewed quite a few writers.
Just about all of them.
Pardon?
Just about all of them.
All?
Well,
all the
ones.
My files are full, Jim. You've done all my research for me. That's great.
The problem is they keep writing. You have to go back and update them.
Well, it's easier, though. Once you have done an interview, you've done a lot of basic research, and when you do it the next time, you know, you've got a lot of that stored away. You can get out your notes. So I've been doing this news report about books and writers for many years, so writers keep coming back year after year.
Oh, that must
year,
be
year,
nice.
Two, three, four times.
That
and,
must be great.
So it becomes easier and easier the second time. And strangely, we never seem to run out of anything to say.
Well,
you really
surprised.
Can't. You really can't. You know, it's just like if we were across the street at the local pub talking, I don't think your conversation and mine would be much different than it is now. Well, I certainly enjoyed The Great Pretender, and I wish you well with it, and I'll look forward to reading what comes next, and we'll have you back. I've done my basic research.
Thank you very much. Should be about 5 or 6 years.
Well, I can't say I'm going to be here, because I notice we're having about 700 layoffs by the end of this month. But
not your show.
You never know. James, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.